Well, good day to the listeners out there. This is Chris Marshall with Classic Learjet Foundation, and we're thrilled to have Leading Edge Aviation Solutions with us today. Joe Carfagna Sr. and Joe Carfagna Jr. are speaking with us, and we're going to share a little bit about both the Classic Learjet Foundation and how we're preserving the history of the Learjet story, and how Leading Edge Aviation Solutions comes along with that story and is a part of that history, and how we share quite a bit of that history together between Leading Edge and the Classic Learjet Foundation. So good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Good. All just well here.
How are you?
Great to hear from you this morning. And what I'm going to do is just tell just a little bit about Classic Learjet Foundation first, and then we'll ask you to just share a little bit about Leading Edge Aviation, who you are today, and then we can get into some of that fascinating history that we share starting back in the day of the original Learjet company and the airplane. So Classic Learjet Foundation is a new nonprofit corporation in Wichita, Kansas, that is acquiring the first ever Learjet to be delivered to a customer, and therefore the first ever purpose-designed, purpose-built airplane. And it was basically the beginning of the business jet revolution back in 1964. So that's who we are. Joe Sr., can you tell us a little bit about Leading Edge, or would Joe Jr., would you prefer to do that? Either one of you, tell us about Leading Edge.
Sure. There's a lot in between from my father's time at Learjet and where we are now at Leading Edge. But we've been an aircraft brokerage and consulting firm with the name Leading Edge since 2004. But going back to 1988, we've been strictly in the aircraft brokerage and disposition, acquisition and consulting business.
So that's over 32 years right there, right?
Yes. So we've been at this for a long time, but I think the story of how we got here and, you know, what we're doing now, but how we got here is the story that's very relevant to the Learjet Foundation, to what you're doing. So I'll let my father explain his history, and you can ask him whatever questions you want of how he got there.
Thank you for that, Joe Jr. Your website, leas.com, has some really wonderful historical information available to anybody who would want to review it. So I can tell from your history on your website that your history with aviation, Joe Sr., goes back to 1967. Is that correct?
A little before that, but yes.
And so you were in aviation sales at Bendix prior to your time with Learjet. Tell us a little bit about that experience and how that led up to starting to sell Learjets in 1967.
Well, the Bendix company was building a lot of radio equipment for the Air Force and for commercial airliners and different things from World War II onward. And after that, they just saw the general aviation thing was coming, Beechcraft and the Queen Air, King Air stuff was starting to come, and they needed radios and so on. And they had the formula for a lot of that, autopilots and a lot of the design ADFs and little DMEs and so on. So they contracted with Lear to supply a number of subunits to Learjet, for the installation into the Lear 23. Autopilot parts, radios, ADF, that kind of thing, was all coming from the Bendix company. And that was in Teterboro, New Jersey, where the manufacturing was done. Part of the radio equipment stuff was done down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida at the time. So one of my early on assignments as the lowest man on the totem pole at Bendix in the engineering department was to go to Wichita, Kansas, to this company called Learjet, and see how our equipment was going into that and to be a liaison between the factory and Learjet. Nobody wanted to go to Wichita at that time. It was it was February and snowing horizontally when I got off the airliner.
I don't doubt it. We are well known for wacky weather, and I think one view of Wichita from back east is we're just kind of a big cowboy town, and you know, and that was probably true at some point in time, but over time it became quite the aviation town. Well, tell us about how you got involved then with Learjet and some of your earlier experiences with them, and if you had any interactions
the equipment was being installed on the airplane, and there was changes and, you know, a lot of engineering stuff and FAA changes, and I won't bore you with all the production line changes and things like that and adjustments. Bill Lear was every day involved on the assembly line coming down on the building of the airplanes in the early years over there. In the beginning, I just saw him peripherally. And then until we started getting more into the airplanes and what was happening as they're getting closer and closer to our certification and building it up. And we had a fair amount of interaction of getting equipment and parts and expedited from Bendix to Lear as components would fail or things like that. And changes were made. And he was notorious for being on the assembly line at 3 o'clock in the morning and making changes and then write it up and then next day tell them to change the whole assembly line.
Which, surprise.
Yeah, it was always a surprise. And the manufacturers of all these various components, we weren't the only one. There was a lot of other landing gear and different things and changes. So you got a lot of interaction with him. He was a larger-than-life character. And one of the days we had finally solved the problem with the autopilot, we had three technicians from Bendix and there spending a week and finally resolved the problem and got it working correctly. He decided to take everybody out for a drink after work. And he took us over to the Carrie Nation Monument. It's the only drink in front of Carrie Nation because she said you can't drink, so we're drinking. And that was one of his crazy things that he would do. And we all sat there drinking bourbon and saluting Carrie Nation. And well, I didn't get all the significance to it until we drove up to the monument of hers there not drinking and stopping all the stuff. Yeah. But that was typical Bill Lear. He could be awful tough, but he could be awful. He was a very smart guy, and the pressure was tremendous as the company was getting closer and closer towards certification. Cash flow was very critical.
Right.
Trying to raise money all the time, getting more investors into it, and so on. Plus, he was always like late paying the vendors, and we were always floating him a few more months and few because Bendix saw the vision that was coming to this thing, and then I didn't see it in the beginning. To me, it was all very, very new. And here's this jet airplane. It was going to be a trainer for the Swiss Air Force. And now he bought the rights to it, and he's going to make this into a corporate airplane.
Right. And,
you know, corporate airplanes weren't the talk of the town in those days.
No, it was a completely new concept, wasn't it? It was like
the only thing they had around was some conversion of World War II airplanes, DC-3s, stuff like that.
Right. And you had your Cessna 310s, you had your Aztecs and Apaches and things like that. That's probably what was considered a business airplane back in the day. So during that time, you then started selling for Learjet.
And well, that came a little later as we got the airplanes going and so on. And then he started to develop a sales team on how to do it. He wanted to do everything factory direct. That was his big plan. Well, Bill Lear's decided that the marketing should be directly from the factory, and he wanted to sell factory direct and not have dealers. He thought that dealers would dilute the value of the airplane, and I was still working with Bendix at this point, and the airplane was going ahead. So the 23 was moving along pretty fast.
Right.
And one of the launch customers was Executive Jet Aviation, which was General May, Jimmy Stewart, and Danny Kaye and a whole bunch of celebrities owned proprietary thing of that. And then Pennsylvania Railroad bought out EJA and started the charter business. And they were a launch customer for the first batch of Lears. First thing was 7 airplanes. The next batch was 7 more. And they had 21 Lear 23s. They were operating out of Columbus, Ohio. And so they were off and running. Now that the production was starting to move and they started to move the airplanes, I got interested as the 24 was coming down the line, and he wanted to expand into the Northeast. And he approached me about it, and because I was back and forth to the factory a lot now as production was moving and they were starting to sell these airplanes. They never sold a Learjet in the Northeast before that. It was mostly, they thought, a Texas airplane, to be honest, and a celebrity airplane. So he said, I'll set you up in an office in New York, and you start doing the marketing and selling the airplanes there. And we opened an office on 11 West 42nd Street across from Bryant Park, and we were right in the center of New York, started pounding on doors, and made a few sales almost immediately. First sale that I made was to a company called Alexander's Department Stores. They bought an airplane. Mack Truck was big, Warner Lambert Pharmaceuticals, and they all started falling in line about getting faster transportation, getting to and from. And as the size of the Lear was not the Royal Barge, as these refer to some of these airplanes that the some of these companies were trying to get to. They said this was the workhorse airplane.
Right.
Back and forth, same day. Company up in upstate New York called Carborundum had two Lears they bought, and Zurn Industry up there. Zurn makes all kinds of plumbing fixtures for all over the world.
I think I've seen the name, yes.
You've seen Zurn a lot, and Carborundum also, all their grinding tools and so on. The pilot for Carborundum set the record with the greatest number of Lear hours ever flown in an airplane. One year, he put 1,000 hours on his Lear 23.
Oh, my goodness sake.
Then he put 900 hours on the 24, and they were a booming company, and Zurn Industry was right behind him with about 600 or 700 hours there, too. So they started opening up the doors, and as I was starting to get these airplanes sold, we came into a problem of trying to find pilots, because most of these companies did not own airplanes. The airplanes were starting to sell, but the problem was putting a flight department together and trying to get them up and running, and it was a kind of a I saw the opportunity that the more I could get pilots and so on, the more airplanes you could sell. That was a big reluctance where people were nervous about just hiring pilots very early in the industry days. So a gentleman had a small company out in Long Island called Executive Air Fleet, and he was operating a couple of airplanes. And he had a management company, he had some pilots. And I said, here's an opportunity. If you can find the pilots that are qualified, that can do this, we can get these airplanes to you, you can manage them. And he did, and it moved along very rapidly, and we were selling Lears as fast as we could get the pilots because it became a hot item for a number of companies in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, not so much in Connecticut, but down in Delaware and places like that where...
Oh, yeah, I would guess Delaware would be a great place to sell airplanes. So during that time of this growth and development, I know Lear was, you mentioned the 23 quite extensively. And what are your recollections about the coming along of the Model 24 and then the Model 25? Did those introduction of those new models excite the market even more, or was it
the 24? The 24 was excitement to bring a more refined product over the 23 with a lot more improvements in the airplane. The 25 is what really started the thing rolling because it was stretched, you had seats, you had a halfway decent kind of lavatory. For the time and place, the range was better.
Yeah.
And it still was a fast, quick airplane and economical to operate. And so that really moved a lot of people out of the 24s into the 25s. And we did sell a lot of those in the Northeast again. And Texas was big and still selling on the 24s because the oil field guys were using those airplanes like motorcycles back and forth all over the place. And they were cheap to buy in looking at it now. But in those days, it was, less than $1 million. Then it went over $1 million. And then the Lear, when the 25 came, the price was up a little bit, but you had a hell of a lot more airplane.
Right.
So,
well, I wanted to get back to the Executive Air Fleet Foundation. And, one of the issues in aviation in general, especially feeding the airlines, is pilot availability and pilot shortages. And it kind of sounds like that was a similar situation, at least for jet pilots back in this time frame, and that was a crucial driver for the establishment of and the growth of Executive Air Fleet. So like that was a pretty good, successful time for you and your company. Can you tell us a little bit more about that period of time?
Yeah, we had gone ahead and formed a more, partnership into Executive Air Fleet. I was getting ready to leave Lear and move on with this because I thought that was the next step in the industry where the management of the airplanes was going to be a bigger deal and also possible chartering of these airplanes, et cetera. The gentleman that was running Atlantic Aviation's management company of airplanes, they had a few airplanes for clients that were in the hangar at Teterboro and so on. He was a retired Air Force guy, William Watt. So we needed somebody that had a lot of experience, had some gray hair, World War II guy, some jet time, etc. We hired him away and had him become our chief pilot. And then we started recruiting from the 89th Special Air Mission Squadron in Washington at the Patrick Henry Air Force Base, the guys that were retiring out of the air missions, which were flying Jetstars and 707s, and they had a lot of jet time, and they were basic rank was a colonel or better.
Yeah, sounds like a highly experienced bunch of guys there, right?
So when they came out of that and we were hiring there, they would come to us and put in another number of years and get a second pension out of everything. But they brought a lot of credibility and a lot of years of experience out there flying jets already, because the Air Force was the only place anybody had a lot of flight time and so on. And then it started mushrooming from there, where New York became a hotbed of financial markets, where after the airplanes, the banks started to jump in. They had never owned airplanes very much. They were very stodgy at that time. Citibank, which was then called First National Citibank, people like that all started to get into the airplane business.
Management stuff, where we were helping sell these airplanes in the metropolitan area and develop air taxi operation, where we started to get an air taxi certificate.
You had left Lear at that point.
Yeah, I had left Lear and gone on to them. But some of the things with Bill Lear at that point were that, you know, first off, sorry to see you go, because the New York office was really smoking hot. But I wanted to leave on a top note with him, and he wanted to shoot me. And he said, you can't leave. I said, yes, but we're going to sell more airplanes for you if we do it this way. He said, I don't believe it. I said, well, let's see what happens. And after the first year, he came to New York, and we went to the Wings Club, and he bought dinner, or lunch and dinner, and hosted a party that we were the premier guys to sell more Learjets than anybody else, and because we could manage them and get them sold and get them delivered and all of that. So it turned out well for him, for us, and for the factory. And he kind of, not a guy to be a lot of kind words, but he did give us some kind words. He's a little difficult to deal with from time to time. He certainly was the stormy genius, as the book said, and he would rant and rave. And most of the time he was pretty correct, but a lot of times he had screwball ideas and say, that's really an impossibility, Mr. Lear. And he said, nothing's an impossibility for Bill Lear, was his slogan that he had.
Yep.
So,
yep.
It started to work out, and then the airplane was getting more and more accepted, and the ease of selling the airplane. There were a number of incidents in the beginning on the Lear 23 that did hurt in the beginning, with some accidents and things that happened, because the training program was almost non-existent, where you would train at the factory in the airplane you bought and so on. And most of these pilots, 90% of them, were coming out of turboprops or piston airplanes into a jet, and they were way behind in the beginning until they got the hang of how to fly a jet airplane.
Right.
Remember, the 23 was a 0.9 airplane.
Yeah, it was pretty fast for its day, fastest thing around. So during that time, you know, the idea of managing a fleet of airplanes, was that kind of a new idea, or had it been around for a while? Because you ended up managing a fairly large fleet of Learjets, did you not?
We did, and it was new at the time, and the only person that operated more Learjets than us was Executive Jet out in Columbus. But we operated a lot of them, and we had a big charter business that we started to build up, and plus we had a couple of outside vendors that had Learjets that threw in with us, and they became part of the team. We had a huge New York charter operation for not only the Lears, but for other airplanes that we were managing.
And you had over 20 Learjets there at one time.
Yep.
In the 70s,
yeah. And then moved it ahead to some of the early Gulfstreams were starting to come in, and bigger airplanes. So, and then Bill Lear, at that point, was starting to get itchy. And when Charlie Gates came on board, it became Gates Learjet and so on, and things changed. And that he kind of left. When he left, it became a whole different kind of company, because he couldn't work for somebody. It was very difficult for him to be reporting to somebody, let's put it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was an exciting time as well at the factory. We discussed the original 23, the 24, the 25, and in this time frame of Executive Air Fleet, that 70 to 83 and on time frame, the Model 35 came out, the 28, 29 Longhorn, and the 55. So what did that do to the market as these new Learjet models came on board? Did that help Learjet to kind of get back or get in the upmarket a little bit with the more capable, a little bit bigger airplanes?
It caused two things. It caused, one, availability of some used Learjets that were really well maintained and well taken care of, and people able to trade up into a 25 or something like that. The 28s and the 31s were a different kind of airplane totally to the market we were working. We were really in the transportation end of it. The 28 was designed for a whole different ball game, mostly for Texas. It was the whole plan, and that's why they call it the Longhorn.
I see.
For the oil field guys again. there was a gentleman called Tagger Mike Davis out of Denver, was a Wildcat Oil guy, and he's the one that pushed them to develop the 28, and he bought a couple of them. He was a wildcatter and made a lot of money and bought Learjets. And then a lot of the celebrities in the beginning with Lear helped that along, and mainly with the board, with Jimmy Stewart and people like that that would come in, Danny Kaye and Sinatra and all those people, you know, promoting this thing. It also helped it a lot. And Bill, when he left, when Gates took it over, he just couldn't work for somebody anymore. And that's when he developed the Lear liner on his own. Then he sold the rights of that basically to Canadair to build the Challenger 600.
Yeah, there's a Lear DNA even in that Bombardier lineup of airplanes today. There's a lot of Lear DNA in that 600 Challenger and also the Global, and even the CRJ had some roots in that same airplane. Well, that sounds pretty exciting about this time of executive air fleet. Can you kind of follow on then with how things flowed and the story of what then happened to lead up to your company today? There was a time of transition, wasn't there, at least?
Sure. I think before we get to that, I'd like to just share something that's stuck in my memory, and it's like burned there. My first, you know, I would go as a kid to Teterboro Airport because it was kind of exciting. I was not a real aviation enthusiast, but to go see all these airplanes there, and they had a hangar full of airplanes and so forth, It was pretty interesting. So one of their contractors that solely dedicated their airplane to charter had a Lear 28. And he did a max effort takeoff with me in the back at probably age 10.
Yep.
And that, you know, when you're sitting in the backward facing seat, you're going to fall right down the aisle if you're not belted in.
You bet.
And I'd never experienced anything like that before, and really no corporate airplane since can climb like that.
63 to 6,500 feet a minute.
Yeah.
Straight up.
I'll never forget it.
Well, Learjet fans, thank you for listening to episode 1 of our interview with Joe Carfagna Sr. and Joe Carfagna Jr. of Leading Edge Aviation Solutions. Join us next time as we pick up the conversation right here in episode 2.